The race is on, and Lewis Hamilton clinched his record-equalling 7th World Championship with a stunning victory in the Turkish Grand Prix from 6 on the grid in what was one of the most gripping races of the season. But how did he do it, and what went wrong for longtime leader Lance Stroll? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer those questions and many more are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Scott, hello, and it is just remarkable to see history being made on days like this, isn't it? We've got to go straight in on Hamilton, 7 times champion.
No, we've got to go straight in on the ludicrous neon pink background that you've got for the recording of this podcast. Are you recording this podcast in like a quiet room at an all-night rave?
It does look like it, doesn't it? It's very strange lighting and everything's a bit of an odd colour. Like my shirt is disconcertingly not the colour it actually is. It's very odd. I'm in an airport hotel at Istanbul Airport that's actually in the terminal. So it's got no natural light or anything. If I had a window, I'd be looking down on the check-in desks. It's funny. I think they've just decided to make the decor of the hotel a little bit like on flights when they have the kind of, oh, it's becoming morning, and you have that weird sort of twilight they bring in. It feels a little bit like that. But yeah, it's unusual. It's a very strange setup. There's like the bed's at a weird angle and it's sort of a bed chair combination, and the desk I'm on's like you pull it out of the wall from below the television. It's all very very compact, but it does the job. That's the important thing.
If it has descended into an all-night rave, then that suggests that your millennial barn dance wasn't particularly well policed.
Exactly. Well, I didn't heed Alan Partridge's warnings there. But there was a question in there, Scott, before you get on to the fascination with my Istanbul hotel room, which was about Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah, I think we have to give credit where it's due. And while Hamilton's critics are always sort of looking for a reason to argue that his numbers have been padded out by having the best car, you know, he's a 7-time world champion now for the same reason he won the Turkish Grand Prix that a few drivers seem to be sort of in contention to win at different points, because he's exceptionally good, and when others tend to make mistakes, you can usually rely on Hamilton not to. He's like a metronome, isn't he? The driver he's developed into is just phenomenally quick and phenomenally reliable.
Yeah, can't say fairer than that. Absolutely astonishing achievement. And Mark, you were there for Schumacher's 7th title in 2004, there for Hamilton's breakthrough season in 2007. Clearly, Hamilton had the potential for great things, but do you think you'd have believed he'd have racked up these numbers so quickly on that famous day when he made his debut in Australia if we told you then?
I would have said it was possible, actually, because he made such a sensational debut and it looked so special coming through. But it is one thing having the potential to do it, another one to actually rack up enormous numbers like that. You need to be, you know, in the right place and then get your bub in the right car and be there for a long, long time. But that's exactly what he's done. I mean, it looked, you know, after Seb's 4th title on the bounce at the end of 13, it would have said that, you know, it's looking as though Lewis is never going to rack up the stats that is level deserves, but it did come good for him with that move to Mercedes, and we're just continuing to see the outcome. It's still unfolding.
Well, we're going to take a really in-depth look at Lewis Hamilton and his career on next week's podcast, because I think to do it justice, we do need to devote a full episode to it. But that's our slightly perfunctory hailing of a remarkable achievement, amazing day. There is a huge amount to cover from the race, so Mark, how did Hamilton manage to win a race that looked like it could have gone to any number of drivers at various times?
Ultimately, because his car was still the fastest car, and it could combine tyre durability with pace. But it took a long time for that to become apparent because of the weird gripless surface of this track. And so it took about 7 consecutive laps before the Mercedes tyres were up to temperature, which is why he was 5.5 seconds off the pace in qualifying, because you don't get to do 7 consecutive laps, of course. So by the time he'd done that, and then in the first wet shod phase, his times were quicker than Stroll's after lap 6, I think. So that was just on the cusp of having to change to the Indus. So then he had to do it all over again. So he's a whole pit stop's worth of time behind Stroll at that point. And he had, you know, Verstappen and Vettel and 2 racing points ahead of him. But then it was just a case of Mercedes weren't intending to change tyres again. They were on the pit wall, pretty sure that they now had, now that they're on the inter, they now had the tyre with which they could get to the end as long as there weren't any safety cars or unexpected rain showers, that sort of thing. And they were quite confident that he would have the performance to do it. But he just had to remain patient. And, you know, we saw him for a time becoming a little bit frustrated, I think, when he couldn't get past Vettel. But he didn't do anything rash in the car. But he was urging the team to rethink the strategy at that point. But they stayed firm. And they were right to do so. And then he just turned it on. And he absolutely executed a perfect race. And probably a couple of iffy strategic decisions made at Red Bull and Racing Point, but ultimately neither of those cars had the pace of the Mercedes, and they couldn't have done the strategy that he did with that performance. And that's it just played out as it did. But it was unusual because the surface had created this weird disparity in the early laps between the cars.
You've broken it down very well there in terms of the constituent elements and almost why it was inevitable Hamilton would win this race. But this is the thing with Hamilton, isn't it? Very often we see situations where you can say, well, this driver's got the cars, the tyres, this should happen, the race should come to them, and it doesn't happen. But Hamilton is so good at making sure that when the stars should align, he makes sure they do line up and delivers in it, because lots of drivers would have found ways in his position to not win that race, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, yes. And there were many temptations there that he could have took, which he didn't, and he was right not to. And we saw Max Verstappen, who at times looked extraordinary this weekend, particularly during some of the early Q2, when he was 2 seconds faster than anyone in the wet. We saw situations there where he could have benefited from being a bit more patient, and that compromises race significantly, but I don't think even that, even without the spin when he was trying to pass Perez, there's nothing that suggests he would have been able to beat Hamilton.
One of the things that I think Hamilton's really, really good at doing is just having that sort of long read, the perception of sort of how a race is going to unfold, and he knows sort of where he needs to be at different points, and he knows sort of where he needs to push, he knows where he needs to sort of hold back, and he's got that. It's just that supreme ability with the tires. You know, we've talked about it on the podcast before, and I'm sure we'll get into it in the more in depth one as well. But just that sort of tire whisperer sort of state that Hamilton gets in, where I think Mercedes sometimes struggle to put it into words. You know, he can just feel it. He knows sort of how far to go. And you know, there was this phenomenon where you took the intermediates to the point where they actually went past the point of being bad intermediates and actually became quite a decent hybrid intermediate slick tire. And it's just that ability that I'm convinced that there's a reason that Hamilton and Perez were the drivers that were able to make that work and other drivers weren't. And obviously we'll get into Sergio Perez later, but yeah, Hamilton is just, he knows when to take a risk and he knows when not to. The closest thing he did to not judging it completely perfectly today was at the start into turn one, when obviously he went inside the Renault, and there was what it looked like, if there wasn't the slightest bit of contact, he forced the other Renault wide. But even that was a incredibly low speed move. It was hardly barreling down the inside like, for example, Valtteri Bottas did half a lap later, that ended up accidentally ruining his own race.
Yeah, it was really only a little bit on that first lap because he had an off on it later on, dropped from third to fifth, and then he went deep into the final complex and dropped back to sixth. So the first lap didn't go perfectly, but yeah, then it did very much come to him thereafter. And I guess we should kind of spool back a little bit to qualifying in terms of explaining why Mercedes looked nowhere in qualifying. Red Bull were looking strong, and then suddenly Racing Point came into it. So maybe if we kind of go back to Saturday to understand that Mercedes pace mark.
Yeah, it was just in this transition from the wet tyres to the inters that caught Red Bull out. Ultimately, the Red Bull was a faster car than the Racing Point, but there was a particular little window where it was on that changeover point where it was a bit vulnerable to the Racing Point, because the Racing Point was the best at switching the tyres on. It had instant pretty much instant. Tire temp, no matter which tire you put it on, it could switch it on. And the Red Bull took maybe two or three laps. And in the conditions at the beginning of Q3 were right on that cusp. And that Stroll, you know, took great advantage of that and delivered perfectly. And Max was extremely hacked off. The circumstances had conspired when he'd been quickest in every session and looked miles quicker than everybody else in the wet, that it should play out by this. And I don't know, to me, it looked as though he was taking that mood with him into the race, that frustration, that desire to prove that he could easily demolish everyone. You know, that I'm sure he felt that, you know, in Q2, and I'm sure he felt that circumstances had conspired to prevent him showing that. And I think that coloured his race, because his race had a lot of emotion in it, I think, and that didn't help him today. But really, it was just about the traits of the car. It was exaggerated by this weird low grip surface, and then, you know, the fact that it was raining and cold as well. But yeah, the differences in cars is that we normally see on a conventional weekend, or, you know, they're measured in tenths, aren't they? But when you can't get in the right tire window, they're measured in whole chunk seconds, you know. So Max was just about on the cusp of getting the inters working, and was probably set to beat Stroll's pole time, but didn't quite do it because it was still a bit edgy, and he had a couple of moments. So it was there for the taking, but he didn't do it. So that's where they were. The Mercs were, as I say, 5.5 seconds off. Just not nowhere near getting the tire. The rear tire temperatures in particular were the problem. They knew the car was quick, but they knew also that it wouldn't do it in the amount of laps you have available in qualifying. And that was just something that caught out the traits of that particular car on this weird weekend with the very low grip surface.
And Verstappen, of course, was one of a batch of drivers who looked like they could threaten for victory in this. So we'll work our way through them. But we should, I guess, start with Lance Stroll. Scott, really good job to take pole position. I've been critical of Lance Stroll at times, but I've always been impressed by him in wet conditions. Yeah, the tyres were in the window, etc. But he did it when it was on the table and got a pole position that will be remembered for a very long time, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. It's not the first time we've seen it. He's very good at. I think he's very good at just sort of having when he has the confidence, he can properly throw himself into a situation. I think that's one of the reasons he's so good. We've seen him be so good on opening laps as well. Sometimes he'll put his car where other drivers feel like he's asking for a crash, but by and large, he gets away with it. And yeah, this isn't the first time we've seen him do well in the wet. Obviously, Monza was it in 2017 was a starring performance in qualifying again. This one was just there is that element of a few cars were just able to get the tyres working on Saturday. The Racing Point was one of them for the reasons that Mark explained. But Lance had to do the job, and just that execution under pressure can't be underestimated. Yes, when the tyres are working, you do have just so much extra grip and confidence that you're not walking the same tightrope as others, maybe. But there's immense pressure there, especially as he had to pull it out of the bag at the very end. He knew that Verstappen would be coming at him. And when Verstappen's been the quickest all weekend and he's in a Red Bull and it's Max Verstappen, you know you can't really afford to leave anything on the line. And fair play to Stroll, because he has come in for criticism. He's been on an awful run going into that weekend. So to actually string it together the way he did, I reckon that was a bit of a relief on his side. But it was a display of the quality of driver that is in there. It's just what's the polite way of putting it? Not necessarily always on the surface.
Yeah, it's refining it for dry conditions, that's the main challenge. And I was pleased for Stroll because, like I say, even though I've been fairly critical of him at times, it's when he's underachieved and underdelivered that he's frustrated me. And he certainly didn't do that on Saturday. So I was pleased to see him doing that. Very, very memorable pole. But we'll have to get into what went wrong in his race, Mark. He led 32 laps. He made that second stop to take a fresh set of intermediates while leading, or that point Perez had reeled him in and looked like he was about to make a pass. But then it just was a disaster for Stroll, wasn't it? And he slumped down to ninth place, couldn't get the intermediates working for a long time in that stint and never really found brilliant pace. It did get better. But, you know, he's driving around at times doing 1 minute 47s when people were doing 141s and 140s, wasn't he?
Yeah. So essentially he'd, in hindsight, his pace should have probably been a bit more controlled by the team, by the pit wall, and you know, on that first set of inters. He essentially took too much out of them and ensured he did need another set. And in hindsight, the way to do the race was the way Perez did it and preserve that original set. Because what happens when you go on a fresh set of inters on a drying track is that they tend to get ripped apart because they've still got a lot of tread on them, and that forms a sort of leverage effect, and they can really grip on the bond with the track surface, and that just tends to pull them apart. Whereas if you're on a set which has been nicely and progressively worn down from wet conditions into dry conditions, it just transitions nicely eventually into a slick, and it can give you great pace throughout. But you have to make sure that you keep it in shape long enough that you don't need to get onto a new set. So basically that was the downfall of Lance. And Perez was going to do that. He was explaining after the race, but he was informed by his engineer that Lance's new inders had grained almost immediately. And that's what veered Perez's guys away from that strategy. And also Perez had given himself that option by not pushing so hard in the previous stint. And so, yeah, that's essentially where Stroll's race went wrong. He just had no pace at all on his second set of inters because they were just... it was unsuitable to put new winters on such a drying track.
Yeah, I was listening to Perez's radio when that was happening, and yeah, that's exactly what happened. It was very much a pit wall call, and all credit to Racing Point for changing their mind quickly, shall we say, because sometimes we see teams not doing that, not reading the signs quickly enough, but they saw it coming, which was positive. A shame for Stroll, because he did a good job while he was in the lead. Yeah, he did not look after his intermediates as well as he should have done, but as you say, the pit wall could have done a little bit to help there. But ninth place is not a great return for him. And to be fair to him, after the checkered flag, he was saying over the radio, he wasn't just blaming that final stint. He sort of said, yeah, we've also got to understand why the pace wasn't there later in the previous stint. So I'm sure he'll learn a bit from that. Probably a positive weekend overall, despite the fact he didn't deliver the result. And actually, lots of those drivers in that group did make the stop for the second set of intermediates. But I guess the counterpoint, as you said, is Perez. Scott, you've been tweeting in recent days about how ridiculous it is Perez hasn't got a drive for next year. He's a high-quality driver, a proven performer with sponsorship behind him, and he's currently without a drive for next year, which is pretty inconceivable. Ninth podium finish, that is, for Perez. He's edging up towards Nick Heidfeld's record of 13 podiums without a victory, but again, just showing his class.
I think Perez is really driving exceptionally well, as good as ever, if not better than ever. I asked him after the race if he feels that this is the best form he's shown in Formula One, and he says he feels that he is at his peak at the moment as a driver, but also what he brings in terms of experience and just sort of how he executes and that sort of thing. I did say in the build up to this race, I'd just been sort of looking back over the season. I just thought it was quite interesting, nothing more than that. That Perez is one of two full time 2020 drivers who has scored a point in every race he started, and the other was about to win the title. I shared a little reminder that, because I said that made it just absolutely ridiculous that Perez doesn't have a drive for next year. So after what he did today, I just did a little reminder to say, by the way, it is still ridiculous that he doesn't yet have a drive for next year. I mean, he's in a point where he is waiting to see whether or not Alex Albon does a good enough job for Red Bull to keep him on. And it's almost like whatever Perez does doesn't matter, because Red Bull will know what it's going to get if it chose Perez over Albon or over Hülkenberg, Nico Hülkenberg, who's the other contender for that seat. But a performance like this is just, well, he can't make a better case, can he? And this is why I feel it would be ridiculous if he's out of a drive. I actually think it would be, as far as very privileged, wealthy person can't drive a lovely F1 car for a living can be an injustice, then Perez not being in F1 next year would be an injustice.
Yeah, certainly agree with that. Great for him to finish second. Just a quick fact, he's 31.633 seconds behind Hamilton in the final classification. And Hamilton was at one stage, I think the most he ever was in any of the mini sectors off the lead was 24.5 seconds. So that tells you how big a swing it was in Hamilton's race. But yeah, great job from Sergio Perez. And Mark, Sebastian Vettel, third place. That's basically the first thing he's had to really smile about this season. Great first lap, gained 8 places. So how did this happen for Vettel, especially with that frenetic action at the end with him nicking the position off Leclerc, who for a moment looked like he was going to be second?
Yeah, as you say, it was the foundation was a great first lap. So he'd qualified reasonably well. He stuck at 11th, which, you know, for a Ferrari in its current form is okay. It was ahead of Leclerc. He made a great start and he took advantage of the bit of confusion between the Renaults and Bottas at the first corner. And then, yeah, he maintained a good pace, took advantage of Hamilton's error on the first lap. Had a bit of a queue behind him in the first stint, but just put his car in all the right places, really, and just did a really, really nice job. Ferrari pulled both the cars in early to get onto the Inders, which meant that they were quite early on their second set of Inders. So they didn't actually, even though I was saying before that getting your original Inters was probably a better strategy, at least they got early onto their second set. And I don't think that car is particularly aggressive on the front tyres in the way that a Racing Point or a Red Bull is anyway. And so they didn't really suffer the ill effects of doing that in the way that the Racing Points and the Red Bulls did. Stroll and the Red Bulls did. They had pretty good pace. Today was all about tire. All weekend was all about tire temperature, and the Ferrari is pretty good at putting temperature into its tires. We saw this at the Nürburgring where it was very cold as well, and so eventually Leclerc got past. His race pace was actually better, and but Seb was still with him, and then of course Leclerc tried a move on Perez on the last lap. It didn't work, and Seb was there to pick up the pieces. So, and really well-deserved podium, and really nice to see him back there, because it hasn't been edifying, has it? Watching him struggle so much.
Now, Scott, I heard Scott lambasting. Scott, you weren't lambasting yourself. I heard Seb lambasting you in the press conference. I wasn't really properly listening because I was on a Zoom to Daniel Ricciardo at the time, but I did hear Vettel taking a bit of umbrage at your question. So can you explain both to me and the listeners exactly what you said?
Yeah, basically, I asked. We were waiting for Hamilton to come in because his time was being swallowed up by the TV crews before the actual FIA press conference. And so we started with just Perez and Vettel, and I wanted to ask a question to both of them, given the significance of their results today. So I asked Checo sort of whether this is the best he feels he's performing in Formula One, and then to Seb I said that this had been a season in which that has been difficult for him. So does he feel that this result is vindication that he is still the driver of the quality that won 4 world titles and countless number of race wins as well? And Checo gave quite a nice answer to his part. And then Seb just sort of said, I'm quite shocked at the way you phrased your question, which shocked me because I didn't feel like I'd asked a particularly nasty question to Seb, but I think he might have interpreted it as me saying, you've been rubbish this year. You're not the driver you used to be. Does this prove otherwise? And but we had a follow-up Ferrari media session a little later, and I wanted to ask Seb a follow-up question anyway, so I took that opportunity to apologize to him for any misunderstanding with the phrasing of my original question, and then hoped that my second question was a little bit more understandable, and he gave me a nice answer, which I took to mean, okay, I don't hate you anymore, so that's good. I don't think he's going to punch me next time I see him. But next time I see him won't be until testing next year, maybe. So I suspect I would like to think he'll have forgotten by then.
Yeah, it's difficult to throw a punch by Zoom. If it was, I'd be throwing them at you during the podcast all the time. But no, only raise hands on Zoom.
I should point out, by the way, that I am actually very happy to see Seb on the podium, because it's been really difficult to see what he's gone through this year. I was really worried that he would be one of the disappointments of the year, from the point of view that he would either have a brilliant season and then it would be a shame to lose him from a race-winning, title-challenging team, or he'd have a terrible season and it wouldn't be a fitting farewell for a driver of his quality leaving Ferrari. And obviously it's been looking like the latter. So I'm really pleased, because I really rate Seb. I really like him as an individual. I think he brings an enormous amount to Formula One. I'm glad he's staying next year, and I'm glad he's got himself into a competitive package and an interesting project. And I'm super happy for him and impressed that he's been able to rally after what's been an awful season and put in the quality of performance that he did at Istanbul.
Yeah, it's a great story. I'm pleased he's just got on the podium even once in this farewell Ferrari season. I have to say, I did also enjoy Charles Leclerc post-race. He was in full-on Leclerc kicking himself territory, where he was taking no solace for the error he made right at the end, when he looked like he was going to get second, and then Vettel had been closing on him, managed to sneak past. But any attempt to give Leclerc any solace, you know, still a good result. He just wasn't having it. He said, no, rubbish, my mistake, which is what I quite like about Charles Leclerc. It was a funny weekend from him, actually, because he seemed to struggle in qualifying. He had that slightly unnecessary clash with Ocon in free practice as well. Good race, though, but perhaps not quite the weekend Charles Leclerc hoped for. Shall we jump down a little bit and look at the Red Bulls? We've talked about Verstappen a fair bit in sixth place and Alex Albon in seventh. But Scott, Mark earlier said that he felt Max carried a little bit of that frustration from qualifying over into the race. I'm certainly inclined to agree with that, because even with all the problems, he still could have got pole. And it was a big part of the tyres, but I think he also probably still knew in him that he could just have got it if things had gone a little bit better. What did you make of what was a pretty eventful and unusual race for Verstappen in terms of amount of offs and little errors?
It wasn't very clean, was it? I think we see this sometimes from Max, where when he almost like he feels like he, it's not that he feels he's entitled to a performance, but he just feels like something that should be in his control isn't, and it just seems to gnaw away at him, and he sort of gets riled up by the fact that it's not going how he feels it should be going. I'm thinking like that practice shunt in Monaco, for example, was it in 2018 in FP3, and little things like the mistakes today, and sort of the mistake in qualifying that ultimately cost him pole. So he just sort of gets a little bit ragged, and I think the bit that obviously ruined his race today was the spin behind Perez. He's really lucky that didn't end up in a shunt and a big bit of damage, and all he had to do was shed a lot of race time and then have to come into the pits for a new set of tyres. But whether it would have let him win the race, obviously doesn't look that way, because the conditions swung towards the Mercedes. But anyway, Max was not making the percentage play there, and one could argue that because he's not in a title fight, he doesn't need to make percentage plays. He just needs to give all or nothing, or he just needs to take an all or nothing mentality, because he's just trying to get race wins. What it doesn't matter to him if he gets another second or a third place. If there's a win on the table, he's going to give absolutely everything to go for it. And I guess that's laudable to an extent, and it's understandable to an extent, but I don't think trying to follow Perez that closely through the kink at what's that case? Is it turn 10 at Istanbul? In those conditions, that's not a smart decision. He's not going to lose out a huge amount by lifting slightly. And it was just weird. You know, he went to the right hand side as well, presumably for a bit of visibility. But you know, he's compromised his line through the corner. And there were a few other times as well where he ran wide, but he kept his foot in when he was going over like painted tarmac and run off. And it's just one of those performances where you're like, this is the sort of thing that you just don't seem to quite have a handle on. And if you were in a title fight, maybe that would be different, because your mindset would be different. When you see it in isolation like that, it's just a few little mistakes here and there that add up to what looks like a slightly frustrated racing driver at times. I think this weekend as a whole was quite frustrating for him, because apart from the race he won at Silverstone, it feels like this was the first weekend where he had actually had expectations. And I reckon that's what sort of brought that sort of negative side out of him, because when you have when you don't have high expectations, you can't fail to live up to them. Whereas this weekend, he had those expectations and it didn't quite go the way he expected.
Yeah, he got a little bit grabby, I think, potentially. It was a little bit disappointing to see, but there were things going against Red Bull. Mark, the other Red Bull of Alex Albon, seventh place. He had a decent weekend. There was points at the weekend where he was very quick. He was still kind of 2 seconds behind Verstappen through qualifying. I think it was 2.3 in the end. He's had this stay of execution with Red Bull now saying that they're going to decide right at the end of the year. Had a spin. Is this a big advancement of his cause, or is he just sort of treading water with an okay weekend?
That was probably slightly better than average weekend for him by the standards of his own season. Didn't do anything that's going to clearly shout out that they should keep him. Looked for a time that it was going very well, but then, you know, strategically, I think they weren't quite their usual sharp self, Red Bull. I don't think they recognised early enough that the strategy was to should have been to maintain the same set of inters. Obviously, Max couldn't do that once he'd flat spotted his, but I don't think that was necessarily the way to run Alex's race either. I think had they switched on earlier to the Perez Hamilton type of strategy, he could have probably grabbed something quite spectacular out of it. I think he maybe could have been up there with Perez or certainly Vettel by the end. But yeah, he didn't do anything particularly wrong. But he didn't do anything to make his case obvious, particularly on a day when Perez was so good.
Yeah, it's a shame. There was a moment when the race was coming to him, and I was thinking, oh, there could just be a chance to do something special here. But yeah, it got away from him a little bit, and part of that is down to the car and the way it was working the tyres. But yeah, decent weekend. We know Albon can do that sort of thing. He needed something a little bit more extraordinary. Well, the driver I skipped to go to the Red Bulls was Carlos Sainz in fifth place. It was actually a very good day for McLaren in the end, with Sainz 5th and Lando Norris 8th. They'd struggled in qualifying, hadn't made Q3. They'd both got penalties, Sainz for impeding and Norris for a yellow flag infringement. But we quite often see Sainz do this in tricky conditions, Scott. Just a really good drive in the wet, made good gains in the second half of the race, came through to 5th place and banked valuable points almost from nowhere, you could say.
I mean, to finish, what was it, less than 3 seconds off of 2nd place, when you consider where the McLaren was in qualifying, that's a pretty remarkable result. And yeah, as you say, it's just another quietly professional job from Sainz. Exactly the sort of performance that means that even though Vettel finished on the podium, so you could argue, finally, we're seeing exactly the sort of asset that Ferrari's losing with Vettel leaving. I can't imagine Ferrari are looking at that too sadly when they see the guy in fifth place and the quality of performances that Sainz is able to produce. This is why he is one of the best drivers in the midfield and why he's earned the big move that he's getting next year to Ferrari.
Yeah, he's done this in these conditions before. Going right back to Toro Rosso days, he's often popped up with these kind of performances. And Lando Norris did a good job to come through to 8th. I don't think he expected points the way the race started off, because I think he went into anti-stall at the start and went nowhere really on the first lap. But again, came through up to 8th place, and that's important for McLaren, because obviously this is a really significant weekend in terms of that battle for 3rd in the Constructors' Championship. Racing Point have moved up to 3rd place on 154 points, McLaren are 4th on 149 points, but Renault are the ones who took the really, really big hit. They're down in 5th on 136 points now, having been up in 3rd and looking favourites to potentially have a good run at 3rd place. Mark, what did you make of what went wrong for Renault? Obviously, Ricciardo got a point for 10th, just ahead of Ocon. It was fairly obvious what went wrong for Ocon, but it was one of those ones that for Ricciardo, he said the first 100 metres of the race went really well, and then it started to go a bit wrong
for
him.
Yeah, I mean, it was it just didn't seem to be, again, it's all about tyre performance, and it seemed to struggle initially to, a bit like the Mercedes, to get the performance. But then it didn't, when it did, it didn't seem to hang on to it in the way that the Mercedes or Perez's Racing Point did. And normally Ricciardo is fantastic at combining tyre life with pace. So if it's not doing that, you would assume it's a trait of the car on the day rather than the drivers. And yeah, he was defending for a long time from Sainz, but ultimately just didn't have the grip to hold him off and spun trying to do so. So yeah, just he didn't, I don't think he really had anything he could work with, and he just salvaged a point out of it, and that's just where I think Renault was this weekend.
Yeah, just one of those weekends. And Ocon, he had that spin on the first lap, and then he was hit and got a puncture by Valtteri Bottas. We'll probably come onto Bottas a little bit later. So Ocon down in 11th place outside the points. Yeah, it's just so difficult in these conditions. If it's not working for you, it's just not going to work. And there are a number of teams who were really struggling. If you look behind, Daniel Kvyat and Pierre Gasly basically spent most of the race in about the same place. The AlphaTauri wasn't getting the tyres working. They struggled in qualifying, and it just never switched on for them at all this weekend. And they basically just drove around. Kvyat said it was a bit disappointing to kind of go through all that effort, shall we say, to get to the end of the race and you get absolutely nothing. Gasly said a similar kind of thing. So they were 12th and 13th. And Valtteri Bottas, 14th place. Now, Scott, it went wrong really for Bottas at the first corner, and then at the ninth corner, I think, on the first lap, wasn't it?
Yeah. He was already running a bit wide into turn one and sort of wasn't having his own moment, I don't think, but he was sort of at risk of a moment. And then as Esteban Ocon, I think it was, his Renault sort of gyrated in front of him, I think Bottas's reaction then meant that the Mercedes sort of spun almost in sympathy. And Ocon was able to sort of keep going ahead. Bottas had to sort of swing the car back around and get going again. And yeah, that was costly, and obviously cost him a load of time, put him back. But the real race wrecker was what happened half a lap later. I was following Bottas on board, and he got a really good run on, was it Leclerc's Ferrari coming out of turn eight, and he moved to the left, quite far to the left on the run down to the slow left hander at turn nine, which I should point out was catching people out all weekend, even in the drive, because it was, you know, it's that big stop and the grip just goes, the rear goes really, really light. And I just saw Bottas go for it on the inside of the Ferrari, and I think that's just, he's never going to get that stopped. And sure enough, all of a sudden, you're just waiting for that moment you're waiting for a brake to lock. You don't know whether it'll be the front brakes or the rear brakes, but you know it's coming because he's taking way too much speed into the corner. And sure enough, the rears lock. He slides a little bit, sails past the Ferrari, and just slides into the absolutely helpless Ocon, who for the second time in half a lap was facing the wrong way through no fault of his own. And I think Mark's got a better understanding of the impact than I do, but yeah, Bottas picked up damage in that incident, and it preceded a miserable race in which I think he spun a total of six times. I thought he was just totally bereft of confidence, couldn't get the tyres to work, which I think is only really half the story, because it wasn't exactly his fault thereafter that he was struggling so much.
Yeah, he damaged the steering. He'd done a bit of aerodynamic damage as well, the front wing end plate. But he damaged the steering, and basically it meant that he could only get so much opposite lock on, then he ran out of lock because of it didn't have its full range. So if he had it sliding too much, he would just spin because he couldn't physically put any more lock on. So he was trying to drive it within those limitations, but obviously that's not ideal on such a slippery surface, because you need to have the confidence that you can correct a slide if one happens. And so this was why he had these six spins. But more than that, on a car that was taken, we saw with Hamilton, seven laps to get its tyres up to temperature, every time he had a spin, you'd lose the benefit of those seven laps that you've just spent getting the tyres up to temperature, when the car's whole seconds off the pace, not just a few tenths, like chunks, 3, 4, 5 seconds off the pace, and you gradually hone it down over seven laps. and then you spin and you're starting again from scratch. So six spins. You know, I think if you're talking about how much time he's lost, he's probably spent 42 of the 50. I mean, what's 53 laps? 42 of the 53 laps trying to get the tire temperatures back that he's just lost through spinning. So yeah, that's why he had the race that he did.
Yeah, horrible day for Bottas. Just pick up some of the stragglers. It's funny actually, in that race, which is, you think, oh, it's going to be a chaos race, wet race, great opportunity for the three slowest teams. And then if you look at the bottom six names on the results sheet, three of them didn't finish. Three of them did. It's the three Class C teams, Alfa Romeo, Williams and Haas. Kimi Raikkonen qualified really well. The Alfa was working the tyres well in qualifying, but in the race, they just couldn't get the fronts to work, and Raikkonen slid down to 15th place. Antonio Giovinazzi didn't last very long. He retired with a gearbox problem, but he had an off and damaged his front wing on a reconnaissance lap, which was fairly embarrassing, but perhaps not the most embarrassing moment for a Class C runner. Mark, did you enjoy George Russell's David Coulthard Adelaide Pit Lane tribute act?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, I felt sorry for him because it was just so much. He had a little bit of a slide coming into the right hander before the left in the pit lane itself. And by the time he'd sorted that out, he couldn't get the thing slowed in time. But it was, we're talking getting it slowed in time. We're talking walking pace, which is what he described it as. And it just wouldn't turn in. That's how little grip there was. And he crunched the nose. And so, but he got it going again and back down to the pit lane. But by the time they got that fixed, pit lane was closed. So yeah, not a great start for poor old George.
Actually, he did say he was going to start from the pit lane anyway, because they wanted to start on the hot intermediates, but that wasn't immediately apparent because it did look for all the world like he caused it himself. I certainly thought that at the time, but I had the advantage of speaking to him after the race. And Kevin Magnussen was classified 17th. He had a problem with the wheel after a pit stop, slightly lost track of what was going on there. But yeah, he said he didn't know exactly what had gone wrong. And Romain Grosjean and Nicholas Latifi, they had a coming together. Actually, Grosjean was lapping Latifi at that point, but Latifi said that he was just struggling to see because he just had all sorts of dirt and everything on his wing mirrors. And when he said when he was being lapped, he was just guessing where people were. And that's what led to the clash with Grosjean, who had a pretty difficult weekend. He, of course, caused one of the red flags in Q1 with, I was watching on board at the time, an admirably committed run into turn one. It was one of those ones. We're always jumping. I always jump around the onboard cameras in qualifying, so I have an advantage there of watching Grosjean. And I thought, you haven't broke. There's no way you're making this corner. He said, oh, front locks. And it's like, no, you were never going to make that corner. But it's very easy on the outside to criticise. Just quite enjoyable to watch. So no points for the struggling teams this weekend. And there probably wasn't ever really in the race once it settled down much opportunity. Magnussen was probably the strongest, actually. He had a good performance. He was probably justifiably irritated in qualifying because he was set to make Q2 and then got shuffled down. He backed off yellow flags. He felt some others didn't, and there were a few who were maybe fortunate to get away with yellow flag infringements. Some did, some didn't. So, yeah, a good cameo from Magnussen, as he's often done in the first part of races. There's a little bit of any other business to attend to. I'm going to set Scott Mitchell off on this just by mentioning the word crane to him. Can you tell a story of the start of Q2, please?
Okay, yeah. I would imagine that everybody listening now is aware of what happened at the start of Q2, where the cars were released from the pit lane, and then as they approached turn eight, you know, the famously fast and difficult left-hand, quadruple left-hand turn eight, there were double-waved yellows, and on the outside of the corner, at the edge of the runoff, the recovery of Latifi's crashed Williams from the end of Q1 hadn't been completed, so the recovery vehicle was still effectively in use, and the marshals were obviously therefore around as well, which caused a mix of confusion and scorn, I think, amongst the drivers, but also several of us watching on. And it was explained away that evening. Michael Masi, the race director, I was quite surprised that he sort of effectively named and shamed, because he said it was the clerk of the course, had given him the instruction that the crane should be out of harm's way by the time the cars got to turn eight. because it was making its way to an opening in the barrier. So they released the cars. Green light. There you go. Away. Crack on. And for whatever reason, there was a delay in the recovery vehicle moving, which meant that that Mazzy needed to basically scramble the double waved yellows at turn eight for that section of the track to slow the car, or to basically ensure that the cars were going slowly, because unexpectedly the recovery vehicle was still in use. And I think maybe my tone sort of gives it away, but I just find it incredible that it was considered acceptable to just take that risk. If the justification for doing that was that it would take 40 seconds or so, however long it takes for cars on an outlap to get from the pit lane to turn eight to clear that recovery vehicle, why not just wait 40 seconds and start Q2 40 seconds later? It couldn't possibly have been that pressed for daylight, even though Q1 had already been delayed that far. So I found that to be an unjustifiable and indefensible decision. And I'm therefore really surprised that Mazzy came out on Sunday evening after the drivers had criticised it and after Sebastian Vettel had said it was a zero-tolerance mistake, and Mazzy basically defended the logic from Saturday evening, saying that he was, I forget the exact phrase, he said he was more than comfortable with starting Q2 based on the assurances he'd been given by the clerk of the course. But unfortunately, assurances in that manner are nothing more than assumptions, which means that you're willingly taking a risk. And I just find that pretty unacceptable, to be honest.
I'm going to choose my words very carefully on this, because yes, I agree with you, Scott. I have to look back to what happened to Jules Bianchi. The reason is, not saying that for effect, in the investigations after that, the FIA recognised that they needed not to have cars at speed when there were mobile cranes, tractors or whatever, recovery vehicles within the bounds of the circuit, and that these would normally be covered by VSCs and safety cars. That was a very, very sensible move. Everything else in the circuit, everything that's normally in the circuit, is designed to be hit. Cars are designed to hit barriers. Barriers are designed to be hit. Cars are designed to hit each other. That's controlled as far as you can. But these recovery vehicles are a factor that's not accounted for, and there's no way you can protect them. It was very, very sensible to move away from ever having the risk of that happening. So for me, for there to be any risk of sending cars out when they had to keep tyre temperature, when that was a real struggle, I don't care that it was an outlap, they were still pushing on. And you don't need to have actually that much speed for something terrible to happen if there is an impact. It's unlikely, but you never know. So the safety standard for that is that vehicle off the track? Not is it going to be off the track in a couple of minutes or in a couple of seconds even. Just wait till it's off and go. Very, very, very simple. I don't think that's a with hindsight thing. And that's why it concerns me, because this is a lesson that's been learned. So yeah, it's just a little bit frustrating. And Mark, it's a very tough job being the race director, and it's very, very easy to criticise the decisions with hindsight, and sometimes the criticism's a little bit unfair, but it is a little bit worrying that we've had a few of these decisions recently. We had the issue at Imola with Stroll going past the marshals, the question marks over the Mugello restart, etc. How do you see it? Do you think they need to be just looking at just tightening some of these things up a little bit, or is it just these things happen in race circuits?
No, I think this particular one is, as I said, put it, it's zero tolerance. It's black or white, really. The other ones, you could argue, the Mugello and the Imola ones, yeah, the Imola one was more of an oversight rather than a clear decision. It was more a situation that hadn't been thought through. The Mugello one, yeah, you probably, in hindsight, you would have done it differently. But it's, yeah, I think the disturbing thing about this one is that it's a lesson that had already been learned. So why is it happening? You know, why was the potential situation there again? And I think a more accepting that you've made a mistake. I think it's important. Everybody makes mistakes, and I think it's important you recognize it and front up to them when you do. And it is a very tough job. and but that's, you know, that is the job. It can't be covered. It can't, this particular incident can't be covered over. It has to be absolutely nailed on from now on.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's an easy one to deal with. You could just say, yeah, actually, we shouldn't have done that. In future, we will make absolutely sure that it's confirmed off the track and have some kind of process where there's the clerk of the course or whatever gives that confirmation to the race director. You could very easily do it. I do find it strange they're in such a hurry, given that Q1 could have restarted after the rain a bit earlier. So they weren't in that much of a hurry there, which just seemed a little bit odd. But anyway, hopefully some good will come out of that. Nothing went wrong, fortunately, so that's a positive. But yeah, one of those things to keep an eye out for. So coming back round to where we started, Lewis Hamilton's won the world championship. This has been on the cards for a very, very long time. I guess we should just have a very brief throw forward, as it were, because there's just no sign of this stopping, is there, Scott? He said himself, I think he's at his peak. He wants to keep going. And this Hamilton era, you know, it's very, very hard. It's not impossible, but it's very hard to see it ending next year, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We had that sort of a bit of fun in games a couple of weeks ago when Lewis was sort of hinting at, you know, no guarantee I'll still be around. And there's obviously something going on in the background in that he's been in no rush to commit his future, because I don't think he fully knows exactly what it wants. Maybe because he hasn't totally thought about it. Maybe because he just genuinely isn't that committed to being an F1 for another 3 years, especially. But after this title, he's made it clear that, you know, he's basically pledged to get a new deal together. He said him and Mercedes are going to get it done. He wants to be around. He wants to keep doing what he's doing with the team. You know, they've got such a great relationship and chemistry. But he is also incredibly, incredibly committed to the off-track side of things. He really wants to make a difference there. It's easy for people to say that he, you know, where was this years ago? Why is he only doing it now? Oh, it's only because it's a global movement. Well, that is kind of the point. He has got massively caught up in it. He's become emboldened by it. He's become heavily invested by it. He's been spurred into this much action because of a resurgent global movement fighting for equality. And he wants to be a part of that. He wants F1 to be a part of that. He wants Mercedes to be a part of that. So he's going to be around for a little bit longer because he's got work to do on track and off track. And that might sound ridiculous for a 7-time world champion who's got a bigger platform and done more for F1's reputation and efforts in efforts like diversity than any other driver. And yet he's still pushing for more. But that's the reason he's a 7-time world champion, because he doesn't settle for good enough. Good enough is never good enough.
Absolutely brilliant for Formula One on and off track. But Mark, the question now really is, when is this going to end? Obviously, 2022 is the big question. But if Mercedes and Hamilton are still together, which they probably will be in 2022, yeah, there's new rules, etc., big question marks. But the reasons that make this team so strong at the moment, there's no specific reason why they shouldn't carry over into 2022, is there? So you are at a point where you do wonder, where there's no way of knowing exactly when the end of this is going to be.
Yeah, I agree. I think it comes to an end when he wants it to. I think it really is in his hands. And the only way he might get more of a challenge is if for 2022 he gets a Max Verstappen in there alongside him, and it's more, you know, you see a sort of Prost-Senna situation where they're going at it every race in equal cars, and that would be fantastic to see, but I doubt whether we'll ever see it. So yes, I think, as you say, this is the best team. It's got where it's got for a reason. Hamilton's very much part of it, is very much an intrinsic part of it and driving it forward. And yeah, I mean, I think it'll continue to dominate until one or the other decides to stop.
Or unless Valtteri Bottas 4.0 or whatever we're due to see next season steps up to the plate. You never know, but no, Valtteri's got an almost impossible task taking on Lewis Hamilton. But an amazing day. It's just been, we've said this on so many post-race podcasts, it's just been equaling the record of wins, breaking the record of wins, constructors' titles, seventh world championship. So, yeah, the superlatives, we ran out of some episodes ago. Scott even tried making some superlatives up recently, and we're probably going to do a little bit more of that when we talk about this on next week's episode, when we delve into Hamilton slightly more broadly than we've been able to do on this episode. Do head to the race's website, that's therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen, loads to read on there. Mark Hughes' race analysis. My driver ratings will be up in the morning. As ever, Scott Mitchell's got a big bag of random tricks he'll deploy on the site, so you can look forward to what's on there. We may even see something from Gary Anderson as well, who was very much enjoying trying to call strategy, watching at home, and doing quite a good job of it in terms of the need to look after the intermediates. He was certainly on the right track. Do also check out some of our sister podcasts, including the Gary Anderson F1 Show and Bring Back V10s, which tells classic F1 stories, and check out our YouTube channel as well. Just search for The Race. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with the look at Lewis Hamilton.